I will now call upon Michael, Alexander, and Kim Aris to come forward to receive the gold medal and the diploma on behalf of their wife and mother, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi.
Now I have the pleasure to invite the Nobel Peace Prize laureate of 1991 to come forward to give us her lecture. We do not have a gold medal because it was received by your son Alexander in 1991, but I'm sure that your words to us today will be written in gold.
Conflicts in the world, they are not mainly about culture and religion. They are about power, resources, land, and so on. But what happens is that political leaders are misusing culture and religion to stir up such conflicts, and it's easy to do it.
The struggle between freedom and tyranny is not confined to any one nation or region. It's a global theme that sadly is becoming increasingly relevant in our time. Around the world, we are witnessing signs of a rising authoritarianism, along with a concerning suppression of human rights and civil liberties. Yet, we also see the courage of those who choose to resist it. The ongoing fight for democracy and dignity in Myanmar stands as a stark example of this global struggle, illuminating a shared human yearning for freedom, justice, and self-determination. In this way, their fight is everyone's fight. And so with that in mind, let's get into today's show.
Welcome back. We are incredibly privileged today to be joined, although unfortunately a little bit briefly, by a very illustrious guest. We have today Kjell Bondevik, former Prime Minister of Norway, who has played a particularly pivotal role, not only in forging Myanmar's relationship with Norway and putting forth strategies and solutions for resolving conflict in Myanmar, but also in many other countries around the world. And we're going to get into many different organizations that he has helped to lead. But before we get into that, please, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to join our podcast and sharing your experiences with us. And I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself for our audience more completely.
Yes, I am now retired from my previous jobs. I started in politics in Norway very early when and was in the youth organization of the Christian Democratic Party and was elected to parliament when I was 26 years, back in 1973, and was elected to parliament for 32 years from my constituency at the west coast of Norway, and was Minister of Church and Education in the middle of the 80s and Minister of Foreign Affairs in 89-90, and ended up as Prime Minister for two terms from 1997 and stepped down in 2005. During the years after the middle of the 1990s, I was engaged in the Burma-Myanmar issues. I was drawn into that by a friend of mine who was leading a human rights and peace organization. And I got contact with Aung San Suu Kyi over telephone and was able to visit her in Yangon in January 97. Half a year later, I became the prime minister for the first time. And I have been working for Myanmar. After that, I promised Aung San Suu Kyi and committed myself to work for democracy and human rights in the country as long as necessary. And still it is necessary. I've had the privilege of meeting the lady several times. Also, when she came to Oslo, I think it was in 2012, to give her Nobel speech. And I hosted her at the Oslo Center, where I then had my work. So I was so happy when she became the state councillor of the country, and so sad when the military made a new coup some years ago and she was drawn back to house arrest. So we still have to work for the freedom of Myanmar.
Absolutely. And I know that we're all very much grateful for the work that, that you have done and that Norway has done. And I want to go a little bit deeper into this relationship because you mentioned hosting Aung San Suu Kyi for her Nobel Prize speech. But of course, she was awarded the Nobel Prize back, I think, in 1991 in absentia because she was under house arrest. And I understand that you you very famously led a delegation, or you attempted to lead a delegation of diplomats to Myanmar to try to meet with Aung San Suu Kyi in 1996, and you were refused by the military, and you ultimately, I think, you met with the government in exile as a result of that. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's right. Since I was, let us say, a human rights and democracy activist, and the government of Myanmar was aware of that, of course, I was denied a visa to go to Myanmar several times. But I succeeded in January 1997 because I was in Singapore for as a speaker on the conference, and I was thinking that when I was there, close to Burma, I could at least try to get a visa. So I went like a tourist to the Burmese embassy in Singapore and asked for a tourist visa. And in my application, I wrote that I'm a pastor in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, which is true. I didn't write that I was member of parliament, because then I was sure to be denied once again. And to my surprise, after some minutes, they accepted my application to go to Burma. And on one condition, they said, since you are a pastor, you are not allowed to have a sermon or a service when you are there. And I said, okay, I'll only be there for 2 days, so I accept that. So then I succeeded to come in, and by another embassy, because Norway didn't have an embassy in the country at that time, I was able to send a message to Aung San Suu Kyi, to the lady. This was in a period when she was out of house arrest, and I got her answer back, and we had a meeting in the residence of the deputy chair of her party, NLD. So I will never forget that. She gave a very strong impression to me. She was so committed to fight for freedom, democracy, and human rights. And as I said, I promised her and committed myself to support her and the democracy movement of Myanmar.
Absolutely. And it seems that you have very much kept that promise. I understand that you left parliament. You say you stood down, I think, in 2005, but you also founded the Oslo Center, and through the work of the Oslo Center, you are committed to, not only in Myanmar but in many other countries, establishing stability and establishing sort of. I understand the Oslo Center's predominant role, and I hope you can elaborate on this, is one of mediation, trying to bring people around the table and find agreements. Can you explain a little bit more clearly, though, what it is that the Oslo Center's fundamental mission is, and the philosophy, the approach that the Oslo Center applies to countries like Myanmar and Sudan and Somalia and Kenya, where you've been involved?
Yes, briefly. I founded together with a colleague of mine from politics, the Oslo Center, back in 2006. And so it's almost 20 years now since that. And in the beginning, we had different projects and portfolios. We worked on some human rights projects, for instance, a report on the situation in North Korea and in Eritrea. We had some interreligious dialogues going on. I remember especially with the former president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, whom I met when we both were in office, and we shared values and what values do we have in common, what is different, how can we use this to mobilize for reconciliation and peace. But more and more we were working on projects that had to do with democracy and democracy assistance. As you already mentioned, we have been to several African countries, especially in Kenya, but also in Somalia and other South Sudan. We worked also with Myanmar in that regard, together with National Democratic Institute. We worked with some of the political parties in the country to share our experience on how to run a democratic political party, how to make coalitions between parties, how to work in parliament, and so on. Today, the Oslo Center is focusing on democracy assistance, and for the time being, in Africa. So we have moved the headquarters from Oslo to Nairobi in Kenya. I have myself, after having worked for the center for almost 20 years, stepped down from every position. But of course, I keep an eye on the center. It is in a way my baby. And I'm glad that the center is going on working.
Absolutely. And purely because I know that we have very limited time, we'll skip a lot of the background and start getting into the more complicated questions. Your tenure as Prime Minister, ending in 2005 and starting in the 90s, you would have overseen the relationship between Norway and Myanmar at a time when we had the 1990 election that was rejected out of hand despite an overwhelming support for the NLD by the people. And you would have stood down as Prime Minister prior to the notional democratization of Myanmar with the 2010 election and the appointment of Thein Sein. My question is, in that period of time when Myanmar was very much visibly and obviously under the control of a military dictatorship, what was the attitude that the Norwegian government took towards Myanmar? What was the hope to influence positive outcomes in a country under circumstances like that? And do you feel that that approach is something that should still be applied post-coup?
Yeah, it's no doubt that Norway worked supporting the democratic movement of Myanmar. And it's always difficult to find out what is the best way to work. Should it be by sanctions and isolation, or should it be by engagement with the democratic forces? I think we tried both tracks. As Prime Minister, I urged Norwegian business companies not to do business with Myanmar because I was afraid that this will only help the authoritarian military regime, but also that non-governmental organization could engage with the democratic movement in Myanmar to help to strengthen the opposition against the military. And I, both before I was Prime Minister and after I was Prime Minister, I worked internationally to make a network of politicians. I established such a network before I became Prime Minister, of democratic leaders from different countries to work on the Myanmar issue, to make pressure on the regime, to support the democratic movement. And therefore, I was so happy when the previous military regime took steps in about 15 years ago to open up, to have a dialogue with Aung San Suu Kyi and other opposition leaders, to release them from house arrest and prison, and also organized elections that were rather free and fair. So NLD won an overwhelming victory. Mm-hmm. Aung San Suu Kyi was elected state councillor, and I looked forward to further steps for a full democracy, mm-hmm. where the military could give up their privileges in the constitution and the privileged seats in parliament and government. And I met Aung San Suu Kyi also when she was a state councillor. She had to balance because she was afraid that the military would make a new coup. And that unfortunately happened now some years ago. And now we are back on scratch, unfortunately. So still, I think both NGOs and governments must work continuously, make great efforts on the combination of support to the democracy movement and a pressure and sanctions on the military regime to pave the way for a new revolution.
Mm. Absolutely. And I appreciate that you say that you encourage businesses not to engage in the Myanmar space. And I even noticed that the very famous Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, now the Sovereign Pension Fund, in 2004, so towards the end of your prime ministership, even I believe implemented an ethics council to oversee the ethics of any potential investments. However, obviously during the tentative democratic period from 2010 until the coup of 2021, Norwegian businesses did expand towards Myanmar. Do you feel that during that period when Myanmar was making these strides, was allowing, after 2015, was allowing the NLD to take government, was holding more elections, do you feel that it was justified to be optimistic about Myanmar and allow more openness, or should Norway have been a little bit more reserved? I know we can't predict a coup ahead of time, but do you have any feelings on this period?
Yeah, of course, we were primarily optimistic, and I think the Norwegian government was, I myself was, because we had the feeling that the development was going in the right direction. It was not a full democracy. Aung San Suu Kyi and her party and the government was relying on the military, no doubt. And we were, of course, afraid of new military coups, but we felt that it was going the right way. And therefore, Norway and other countries also stimulated business companies to invest, for instance, Telenor from Norway, because we hoped that this will help the economic and also the democratic development. Because we were thinking that if business investments contributed to improve the living conditions for common people, they would be more satisfied with the more or less democratic regime that we had in Myanmar during this period. So maybe we were too optimistic. It's always difficult to say. Maybe the Norwegian government and the Norwegian business life were too optimistic. But it was very difficult to have another approach, because mm-hmm. we wanted to support the democratic development of the country.
Mm. Are there, I wonder, how many mechanisms do you feel that you as a government have? Obviously, there's giving legal recognition to a state and opening an embassy, and you have the option of investing and sending businesses. Are there other mechanisms, are there other tools at the disposal of a government to try to lobby foreign governments and foreign regimes and try to reward them for good behavior or punish them for bad behavior?
Well, I think they have to work internationally, not only bilaterally. The UN has, of course, a great responsibility, and I have talked to to several UN Secretary Generals about their responsibility to work on the Myanmar issue. I would welcome more engagement from the UN. The same with other international organizations, especially like ASEAN, where Myanmar is a member. And they should have this two-tracks policy of pressure and sanctions on the one hand, and support to the democracy movement on the other. So unfortunately, Myanmar has come in the shadow of the wars going on in Gaza, in Sudan, in Ukraine now, and it's too little focus on the situation on Myanmar. Yes. So I try to do my best personally to change that situation so we can get more international engagement.
Absolutely. And with going back to 1996, when you met with the opposition, I think that was a very powerful, very poignant political message to send. And I'm sorry to be, you know, blunt. I know this is sometimes a very difficult question, but do you feel that the Norwegian government should be formally recognizing the national unity government, similar to how you met with the government in exile? Or do you think that that would not be a productive step?
It's difficult. Normally, a government only recognizes governments that have control in the country. And we know that the government of unity in exile doesn't have. On the other hand, we know that the current military regime in Myanmar either have control over all of the country. Conflicts are going on in some of the states. So it's a complicated situation, but so I don't want to criticize the Norwegian government. I know that they are doing what they think is best for democracy of Myanmar.
Absolutely, and I definitely don't want to put you in a position where it sounds like I'm asking you to criticize or pass judgment. But I also want to look a little bit at ASEAN. So I noticed that you seem to be an advocate for locally led solutions, African solutions for African problems, instead of what, you know, to use the traditional term, the white savior solution that we have seen historically. Do you feel that ASEAN's response to the Myanmar crisis is sufficient? Do you feel that ASEAN is a vector through which other countries should be trying to help resolve the Myanmar conflict? Or do you feel that it is more appropriate to bypass ASEAN and independently try to try to impact the conflict and de-escalate?
I feel that ASEAN should have had a much more active role. They are very careful. I can understand why, because they have member countries as well that are on a more or less a friendly footing with the current regime. So it's not easy, but I think that if we should contribute to a change, the international community and organizations that have a real influence in the country should be more engaged. Of course, everybody knows that China is a key here. Because of their investments in Myanmar, their consequently their political influence, the same to some extent with India and other neighboring countries. So we had to encourage them to go on working for a change. But of course, countries that are not fully democratic themselves don't see the need for supporting democracy in Myanmar.
Absolutely. And I'm very glad that you brought up China. Being such an enormous country, being so close, having such a large economic impact on Myanmar, and as we know, also having so many relationships with ethnic armed organizations in the country, do you feel that China is in a position to simply undermine the efforts of many other countries in the international community by offering the military an economic and a political and even in some cases a military backup, somewhere that they can always go to where they will receive help as long as they are willing to do business with China on China's terms, they will be able to continue doing whatever they want to do domestically within the country. Is that an obstacle to a unified international response?
Yes, I think there's no doubt that that it is an obstacle. But we have to look back to the last time when the previous military regime started on a change in the country. I think that it was a combination of international pressure and an uprise from the democratic movement in the country. The international community cannot make the change itself, but it can help. And I do, and I think also the military regime at that time saw that their way of ruling the country would not be sustainable in the longer perspective, and that they wanted to contribute to a peaceful transfer to a more democratic country. And I hope that the military regime once again will think in these ways. We know that such authoritarian regimes are not sustainable in the longer perspective. Sooner or later, they have to make a change, and why not contribute to it themselves? And I hope some leaders will be able to convince the military leaders that this is the way to go.
And on the topic of convincing military leaders, obviously, having interacted with Myanmar, the military leadership is naturally going to be key stakeholders. There must be connections on the Norwegian side, on the government side of many, many outside countries, with key figures within the Myanmar military, direct lines of communication, as well as direct lines of communication to key members of the resistance, the National League for Democracy, the National Unity Government, and so on. And my question here is, and you may or may not be able to answer this question, so I leave it up to you, but do those lines of communication still exist? Are people communicating with members of the democratic resistance? Are people communicating with members of the military and trying to find resolution through dialogue, through quiet discussions behind the scenes? Or after the coup, is it simply the case that a lot of those avenues of communication have been severed and one side or the other side is just unwilling to continue speaking?
Yeah, of course, since I'm not in politics any longer, I'm out of government, and I have also stepped down from all positions at the Oslo Center now. I don't have enough knowledge about what contacts they have for the time being. But I assume that the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Norwegian government have channels to both sides in Myanmar, to the current government and to the democratic movement. And now, different from back in the 90s, Norway has an embassy in Yangon. They are close to the situation. They are close to the leaders on both sides. And I do hope that I use these opportunities to contribute and coordinate themselves with other countries.
Absolutely. And again, without compromising any safety or any relationships, I wonder, have you yourself managed to maintain connections with any of the people that you've been working with on the Myanmar side for so many years, even in these difficult times after the coup? I imagine, obviously, you would not be able to communicate with Aung San Suu Kyi, even through intermediaries at this time. But are there people in Myanmar that you are still connected with within these democratic organizations?
I don't have a direct contact any longer with the democratic movement inside Myanmar. Aung San Suu Kyi is, as we all know, isolated. It's not possible for me and other international leaders to approach her, unfortunately. The same with the government, they are not interested in, I think. So, but I have, of course, some contacts with Myanmar people and politicians living in exile, and democratic movement outside the country. So I still try to contribute.
And we definitely appreciate it. I'm also conscious of your time restriction. So the final question I will pose to you, and without trying to make it sound like I'm trying to draw a criticism of the government or anything like this, but in your experience and in your opinion, what do you think would be the most efficient path forward for Norway as a state in trying to make a positive impact in the Myanmar crisis?
I think that the government should strengthen their efforts to contribute to democratic development by, of course, raising this issue in international bodies, in the UN and other relevant fora, because now it's almost forgotten over the last years. Secondly, I mean that they also should coordinate their efforts with other countries that have the same approach and use channels both towards the regime and towards the democracy movement in the country, and also play on international and national NGOs in this regard.
Excellent. I don't want to take up any more of your time because I understand how precious it is and we're very grateful for it. But before we finish our interview, we always allow our guest to leave us with the final thoughts. If you have any message or if you have any thoughts that you would like to share either to the Norwegian audience, to the Myanmar audience, or to anybody who's listening, we would like to give you the opportunity to share your ideas.
Yeah, we are in a very sad situation with regard to democracy and human rights in Myanmar, as we have been in periods also earlier. It's very easy to be pessimistic and to give up. But we know from history that it's possible to change the situation. It has happened before. It may happen again. So I will encourage all who believe in democracy and human rights to work actively on the Myanmar issue and one day, hopefully, to see a new revolution where people can elect their own leaders in a democratic and fair way, and that the economic and social development of the country will make better living conditions for common people.
Thank you for being a part of this conversation and standing in solidarity with the people and the stories shared here. At Insight Myanmar Podcasts, solidarity is not just a word. It's the foundation of everything we do. Each voice we amplify and every story we share represents a call to stand together with those in Myanmar. And so it is through the act of listening, reflecting, and engaging that you become part of this collective effort to uphold dignity, amplify truth, and stand firm for what matters. And I should also add that all of this work is only made possible because of listeners like you who have chosen to offer a contribution. Every donation is an act of standing together, of refusing to turn away, and of reinforcing the bonds that connect us across borders and experiences. If you believe in the power of solidarity and the importance of sharing these stories, we invite you to join us by making a donation. Your support helps us to keep this platform alive and ensure that those voices continue to be heard. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to join us in standing with Myanmar. Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,